This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. When we think about leaders in the struggle for civil rights in this country, chances are these are some of the names that immediately come to mind. Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, James Farmer, Andrew Young, and Jesse Jackson. But what of the women who have fought for civil rights? This afternoon, we'll hear about some of the women who were key in the fight for civil rights. Ida Wells, Pauli Murray, Lillian Smith, Rosa Parks, Ella Baker, Diane Nash, and Bernice Johnson Reagan. Some of the names of these women might be familiar, but others are likely unfamiliar. Our guest is Lynn Olson, author of the new book, Freedom's Daughters, the Unsung Heroines of the Civil Rights Movement from 1830 to 1970. Lynn Olson, together with her husband Stanley Cloud, is also the author of The Murrow Boys, Pioneers on the Front Lines of Broadcast Journalism. Her new book, Freedom's Daughters, is published by Scribner. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for Lynn Olson. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Lynn Olson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
What led you to this project?
It was several years ago. I was looking for a new book to write. I had done a lot of stories on women's issues. I had been a journalist for about 10, 12 years. But I really wasn't thinking about doing a book on women. I was rereading Taylor Branch's wonderful biography of Martin Luther King, the first volume, Parting the Waters. And in reading it, I came across the name of a number of the women that you just mentioned, who I had never heard of before. And Taylor had devoted maybe a couple of sentences or at the most a paragraph to some of these women. And I wanted to know more. And I started looking around to see if books had been written about these women, and found that there really was no book about the achievements and the accomplishments of women in the civil rights movement. And so I decided to write it myself.
One of the things that is so surprising is that there are so many women, and their stories are so so moving, so inspiring.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it really stunned me to when I got into the research to realize that there weren't just a couple. I mean, most of us have heard of Rosa Parks, and maybe a few of us have heard, a number of us have heard of Fannie Lou Hamer. But in fact, there were women all over the South who were critical in the civil rights movement, who were critical in making it a mass movement. And the stories are just stunning. They remain stunning to me, even though I've been familiar with them for a number of years now. And it's also stunning that the fact that these women are still unknown after all that they did.
Yeah. Another thing that emerges in the stories of these women, is great courage and great tenacity. Give us some idea of the sacrifices they made, the dangers and the humiliations they faced.
Well, there's no question that was true. And I think people don't realize that. One of the major points to be made about these women is that most of them were unsung. They did what they did in a very unpublicized way. They weren't out on the front lines in the sense that journalists were covering them. Many of them were mothers and wives who were mounting the fight for civil rights in their own communities. And they were not... They were facing the same kind of hatred and hostility, the same kind of potential for death that the men were, but they were doing it in a very unsung way, and it was something that they faced constantly. I mean, it's hard to remember especially for those of us for people who weren't born then, but it's hard even for those of us who are around to remember what it was like, particularly in the South, to be fighting for the rights of African Americans to vote and to share the same rights that the rest of Americans had. They really were taking their lives in their hands, and that was true of the women too.
Yeah. Was there ever any efforts to right the wrong of these women, that they were unsung, that they have been unsung?
Well, actually, there have been some biographies of particular women. Fannie Lou Hamer, for example, there's a wonderful biography that came out a number of years ago of her. Rosa Parks wrote a book. But for the most part, because I think journalists and then historians tend to focus on men, and especially Martin Luther King, and their incredible achievements, and I'm by no means do I mean to downplay the achievements of the male civil rights leaders. But what women did tended to fall between the cracks, tended to be unsung. I think the point needs to be made that, again, that the men were the ones who were used to being out in front, to being in the spotlight. Women in the 60s, regardless of race, regardless of class, generally were working behind the scenes. That was the way the society was. And the women in the civil rights movement were no different. So, you know, they not only, most of them didn't really want to be out in front in terms of the publicity. They were very content, most of them, not all of them, but very content to work in the background, to work for what they believed in so ardently, but not with the publicity that the men were used to getting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of these women who mm-hmm. have been unsung, and to many of us until your book, we're unfamiliar with. Polly Murray, interesting woman who emerges early in Freedom's Daughters. She wanted to earn a graduate degree from the University of North Carolina. She applied,
right.
Turned down in 1938 because of her race.
Exactly.
But she didn't let it go.
No, she didn't let it go. Polly Murray, it's interesting that you mentioned her race, because she really is my favorite of all of them. And she came before a lot of the women. I mean, she was a pioneer for civil rights in the 1930s, 1940s particularly. She was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, was just an amazing woman in terms of what she accomplished. When she was turned down at the University of University of North Carolina, she ended up at Howard Law School, one of the very few women in her law school class. She led a sit-in at a Washington, D.C. cafeteria in the early 1940s, long before sit-ins became, you know, one of the major instruments of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. I mean, she really led the way in so many ways. And she continued that fight. She continued that fight for civil rights throughout the rest of her life. And, you know, we could talk more about what she did, but she was just an astonishing person. And to me, what's astonishing is that so very, very few people have ever heard of her. I mean, her life could make a fabulous movie, and yet, you know, she remained fairly unknown.
Also, it's very interesting to me that she was the person that she was, given that she came out of a childhood, as you put it, that was filled with bewildering contradictions.
Yeah, she to me is particularly fascinating because she left a lot of material about how she felt growing up. And how she felt during her struggle for not only for civil rights but later for women's rights. She came from a family that was very, very, very proud of its African-American heritage, but on among some members, very, very proud of their white heritage. Her great-great, I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly the greats now, one of her great-grandmothers had several children by white men, basically had been raped by the masters in her household in North Carolina. I mean, she was a slave. The Polly Murray's grandmother, who was one of those children born of white men, was very, very proud of being, you know, of having this white ancestry. So Polly Murray was raised with this kind of this dichotomy. She was very, she was part white and part African American, and it was very hard for her to reconcile that. You know, that split. You know, she was angry, she was bitter, and at the same, she just really didn't know how to deal with it. And that was one of the main, I think, things that propelled her into civil rights. And finally, toward the end of her life, as I tell in the book, she really became reconciled to the fact that, you know, she was not one thing or the other. And she became very much a very strong force for reconciliation of the races.
She died in 1983.
Yes.
Looking back at her life at the end, what did she see as the accomplishments and the unfinished work?
Well, she, I think, was very proud of what she had done in terms of civil rights and leading the way, and also in terms of women's rights. And we should mention, by the way, that she, she was always ahead of her time. She's always ahead of her time in terms of what she did for African Americans and then for women. She became a lawyer after Howard Law School and worked very hard in terms of legislation on both counts. But then toward the end of her life, when she was in her 60s, she had become a professor at Brandeis, gave up her tenured professorship at this university, and entered the Episcopal Seminary in her late 60s. It was a time when the Episcopal Church had not yet begun ordaining women as priests in the U.S. I mean, she was only hoping that this would happen. And if it didn't, she didn't know what she was going to do, but she felt so strongly about the need to bring people together. She had seen by that time, we're talking about the 70s, she had seen what had happened to the civil rights movement, that it had fractured. She had seen what had happened to the women's rights movement, which she had been very active in, which had also fractured to some extent. And she felt very strongly the need to bring people together, and that's why she went into the seminary. In fact, the Episcopal Church, as we know, did finally open its doors to women priests. And Polly Murray was the first African-American woman to be ordained in this country as an Episcopal priest. And that, to her, I think in many ways, to her, that was the culmination of a career, of her career. That, I mean, it brought all the threads together. And she was the priest only for a few years. She died, as you said, in 1983. But I think it was a source of profound satisfaction for her.
Yeah. We just talked about Polly Murray and the fact that her female relatives, her great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, whichever it was, had been raped and by white men. And this is such an important part of this story, the intertwining of race and sex.
Yes.
In the history. And you write about historian Darlene Clark. You mentioned her briefly, mm-hmm. who has written that many black women moving north during the Great Migration at the end of the 19th century did so to escape sexual exploitation and the possibility of rape. Talk with us, if you would, about the dangers these women faced.
It was a danger when we're really talking about slavery and the days immediately after slavery in the Jim Crow area, and the danger exists to some extent today. Under slavery, black women were at the mercy of white men. And I have a quote in the book from a historian that said that basically it was very difficult for a young black woman to escape. I mean, not every black woman was raped, obviously, but it was impossible for a black female slave, or very difficult for a black female slave to say no. I mean, many, many women resisted. but they were regarded as property, and this was considered a right of ownership and on the part of white slave owners. And in fact, many black women were raped. And if you look at the colors in our society today, the colors of people, you can tell that there has been a lot of intermingling of African Americans and whites over the years, and much of that began during the days of slavery, when black women had nothing to say about whether they would have sex or not. So that has played an enormous role in the way in the way we have lived our lives, and I think it's the intermingling, as you say, of sex and race is not really not talked about very much to this day in this country, but it has had an enormous impact on how black women have been treated through the years, how white women have been treated through the years, how black women and white women regard each other from the days of slavery until now. And it's something that I think needs to be grappled with. I mean, it's something that we really need to bring out more into the open and to deal with, because I think it really has had a major impact, major influence on
all
race
of us.
And sex.
Yeah. And you didn't mention black men, but of course.
Well, of course. Oh, yes. Absolutely. It has impacted the way everybody treats everybody else. It's not just, I mean, I deal with women in the book, but certainly in terms of black men and white men, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's had an incredible impact.
We've got a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Let's go and talk with this caller. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was particularly interested it's fascinating that a woman in the 30s accomplished all that she had, because black or white, for a woman in the 30s to accomplish that was not easy. But I'm very interested in some of the women of the actual civil rights movement as it formulated in the 60s and 70s. Could you speak about them?
What would you like to know?
Well, some there are names that you mentioned,
sure,
that I had never heard of.
Sure. It's not a trouble, but the trouble with the 50s and 60s is there were so many in so many different areas. I mean, I deal a lot with, in the book, I deal a lot with students, with the young students, for example, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a lot of the young women who were involved, names that Celeste mentioned, people like Diane Nash.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I find fascinating the women in Montgomery, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Rosa Parks, but, right. Again, most of us know about Rosa Parks, but most of us don't know that in fact it was women who began the boycott. I mean, Rosa Parks was the catalyst for the Montgomery bus boycott. But I think a lot of people think Martin Luther King was the one who was behind the boycott, who led the boycott. He was in charge. He was the president of the organization, the formal organization. But the people who actually began it, the people who actually ran it, were women. Particularly a couple of professors, one professor in particular at Alabama State College, a historically black college in Montgomery, and she was the one who came up with the idea. She had led this organization of women in Montgomery for a number of years and had been adamant, I mean, had been working really, really hard to get the Montgomery Bus Company to change their rules about how African Americans were treated on the bus. And had not accomplished anything. And then it's a long story, but when Rosa Parks was finally said, "I'm not getting up. I'm not going to the back of the bus," this sparked this woman's group to begin the boycott. And only after a couple of days did Martin Luther King really become involved. He was brilliant in his leadership in terms of inspiring and energizing. But the people who actually did the day-to-day organization of the boycott, and by the way, the people who were actually participating in the boycott, the people who were walking, were mostly women.
And what is that lady's name?
Celeste, you have the book in front of you. Joanne Robinson. Sorry, Joanne Robinson was her name. As I said, she was a professor of English at Alabama State College, and she never thought any recognition. One reason is because if it had become known that she had started the boycott, if she was known as the main organizer, she would have been fired, because that college was a state-run college, and the state legislature would have instantly fired her if they had known. In fact, they did find out a number of years later, and she was fired. But she also, you know, again, was a woman of her time. She did not think it was, she didn't really particularly want to take credit for it.
But she was the one who organized the group that started.
Yes.
That started walking.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And again, the thing that I find, one of the things I find really interesting is it, you know, people again talk about Martin Luther King and the people at the top, but if it hadn't been for the maids, the cooks, the domestic workers who were the ones,
the seamstresses, mostly, the child care workers,
right, exactly, yeah, they were the ones who rode the buses for the most part, and they were the ones who decided they weren't, you know, they were going, they were not going to get on that bus. Until the rules were changed, and they didn't. I mean, for more than a year, they walked in all kinds of weather, they by doing that, they really started this country on a revolution that was propelled into the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other women of the era?
There were many, many other women in the 50s. Unfortunately, you know, there were so many women that I did not talk about a lot that really, you know, are unsung today, because there just was no room to talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
Ella Baker is another one that Celeste mentioned, who is a fascinating woman that most people don't know about. Her roots in civil rights also go back to the 40s. She was an official of the NAACP, was a field secretary. He went into the South in the 1940s when to be associated with the NAACP was, you know,
dangerous.
You know, you could have been lynched.
Mm-hmm.
And she drove around the South recruiting members for the NAACP and basically trying to get people, African Americans, to stand up and to fight for themselves. She continued her career until the 1980s. She was one of the founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which Martin Luther King became the head of, but she actually was one of the founders. She was one of the organizers, and she was really the first executive secretary. She did a lot of the grassroots work while Martin Luther King was out, you know, in front giving speeches. She became quite disillusioned with his way of leadership. She felt that it should be the people who should be leading, not, you know, it should come from the bottom up, not from the top down, which was very different from his style of leadership. And so she left and then became the kind of the guiding force behind the student movement with the sit-ins and the marches for voting rights. So this woman had an extraordinary impact on the civil rights movement that very, very few people know about. Mm-hmm. In many ways, in fact, a number of the people, the young students or the students that she worked with, people like Stokely Carmichael, told me that they thought that she, more than anybody else, was the main figure of the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can hear from the way you speak that you're not interested in pitting women freedom workers against male freedom workers.
No.
But that it, you thought it was time for women to be a little bit more recognized.
Right. I mean, I think there have been many, many books written and much talk about what men accomplished, and all of that is absolutely accurate. There's no question that's true. But I just thought it was time for women to get the credit they deserve. And as I said, if it hadn't been for women, especially for women in the Deep South, and we're talking about the, you know, from basically 1961 until really now, it would not, the civil rights movement would not have turned into the mass movement it did, because most of the people who were actually working in the movement at that time were women. They were, there's no question. I mean, you know, the male leaders of the day say that. I mean, nobody could question that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Fascinating book. And you spell your name O-L-S-E-N.
No, O-N. O-L-S-O-N.
O-L-S-O-N.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Comments, questions, they are invited. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Lynn Olson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her book, Freedom's Daughters, The Unsung Heroines of the Civil Rights Movement from 1830 to 1970. My name is Celeste Quinn. Lynn, let's go back and talk some more about Ella Baker, because as you said, she is a fascinating and very, very important figure in the movement. Now, her childhood was so different from Pauli Murray.
Yes, it was. Very, very different. She was raised in a atmosphere of very strong African American pride and solidarity. She, her grandfather, was a minister, a former slave in North Carolina, and he owned quite a bit of land, which he kind of parceled out to relatives and to other people. And he took care of that. There was this great sense of community and solidarity that she grew up with. And as a little girl, she used to go with her grandfather. Her grandfather treated her not like a girl, but you know, like a grown up adult whose opinions counted. I write in the book, which I loved, he would put her in church when he would preach. He would put her in the visiting preacher's chair. So she would be up there on the altar looking out over the congregation. And at that time, you know, women were never on the altar, whether they be in African-American churches or white churches. I mean, women were not ministers. They didn't, you know, they took care of the church. They weren't up there. And her mother, Ella Baker's mother, used to just get very upset when she would see her daughter up there. But that kind of sense of pride and dignity and worth was part of Ella Baker for the rest of her life. I mean, she never, ever suffered maltreatment, mistreatment, discrimination very well. She always objected. She was out there all the time insisting on her rights and the rights of other African Americans. So yeah, I mean, her grandfather and the way he treated her treated other people had a tremendous impact on the way she lived her life.
Yeah, she was egalitarian at the core.
Absolutely, absolutely.
When she married in 1940, she did not take her husband's name.
That's right. That's right. And again, in 1940, you know, that was unheard of. But she insisted she was her own person. She did not belong to anybody else, regardless. She was going to, her own identity was so precious to her, she wasn't going to, she wasn't going to, abide by anybody else's, thoughts or feelings in that regard.
Yeah. Now, given that background, how did she cope or not cope with the hierarchy of the Southern Christian Leadership
Conference?
Oh,
she had a really difficult time. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, like most civil rights organizations, again, you know, I don't want to single out African American men, because that was true of all men in this country and really throughout the world at that point. It was a very, very male-oriented organization. The men really didn't have much time for women in terms of you know, being policymakers, or they didn't really even listen to them very much. Ella Baker had founded, as I said, had helped found the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she helped recruit or got Martin Luther King to head it, and then was brought in basically to start it up, to see it go, to run its day-to-day operations for a while. But Martin Luther King never really listened to her. I mean, she was about twice his age. She was old enough to be his mother, and he quite frankly was quite a sexist in many ways. He thought women's place should be in the home, and so he and Ella Baker never saw eye to eye in terms of many things, particularly the role of women. She wanted very much to get women involved in the civil rights movement and in getting it going. Because remember, at this time, when the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was founded, there really wasn't a mass movement yet. That's what they wanted. That's what Martin Luther King and everybody involved wanted. But they really weren't doing the work that was needed to get people by the hundreds and thousands involved. Ella Baker very much wanted women to be part of that, you know, to be the engine to get that going. He did not agree. For that, for many other reasons, she decided she'd had it. She wasn't getting her due. She wasn't getting credit. And so when the student movement started, when the student sit-ins began in 1960, she saw that as the way for the civil rights movement to go. At that point, she saw and she knew that if it were going to have an impact on this country, that it had to be at a grassroots level, and that's what the students were doing. And so she became the kind of the main force in many ways behind the student movement. When the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee began, she really became its energy. I mean, she helped the students from then on, from that point on until her death, in that movement, and she was absolutely committed to it.
Yeah, and she inspired so many.
Oh,
folks.
You know, talking to people now who are involved in the movement who knew her, they still talk of her with extraordinary. I mean, they have awe in their voices, you know, and great love and admiration and respect. I mean, it's. I have very rarely heard anybody talked about that way, the way, you know, people who've become prominent in their fields. Talk about Ella Baker. I mean, she had an influence on so many lives and was so important in so many ways.
Bernice Johnson Regan, I know, was deeply inspired by Ella Baker, and I think has written. Bernice Johnson Regan is the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock,
right,
and a cappella group. I do believe, I haven't sat down and listened to Sweet Honey and the Rock for a while. I think I should, but. I believe that she's written some music and lyrics to honor Ella Baker.
She has, yeah. There's one song in particular, and I can't remember the lyrics or the title now, but she has sung about Ella Baker, and she sung "Sweet Honey in the Rock," which is an a cappella group of African American women, which is just spectacular. They sing a lot about the civil rights movement. They sing songs that obviously have considerable application now. But Bernice Johnson Regan has certainly not forgotten her roots in the movement, and it's part of her to this day. And Ella Baker is certainly part of her. I mean, she talks whenever. And on a number of occasions when I've heard her talk, she always mentions Ella Baker.
Yeah. And Bernice Johnson Regan was a student when she got involved.
Yes, She was a student in Albany, Georgia, of all places, in a fairly small town in southwestern Georgia, and at a school. She was a college student, at a African-American college and was kind of despairing. This was in 1962, and she thought the civil rights movement was going to pass Albany and Georgia by, which it did not, and she came rapidly caught up in the movement in Albany, which was in many ways as life-threatening and dangerous as the movements in Mississippi and elsewhere. She was one of the leaders in that movement, and then became and found her own destiny in singing. She became Albany. It was very well known for its singing, the Albany movement. Extraordinary voices among the civil rights workers . And she was one of the leading singers in that group, and she became a member of what's known as the Freedom Singers, which is a group of young student workers who went around the country singing and raising money for the movement, and that's where her career started.
Mm. Diane Nash, also a student when she became involved. She was a student at Fisk. And
yes,
her route to this activism is really interesting. She grew up in Chicago,
right,
which is one of the most segregated cities to this day.
Right.
Yet she was so protected, and it wasn't until she was it Nashville to visit the Tennessee State Fair that
right.
she just got mad as hell.
Yeah, she did. She grew up in a very protected, as you say, middle class environment, and it really is quite surprising that she didn't experience much discrimination. But she says she didn't, and she also went to Howard for a year or two, and didn't run into much of that there. It was only when she transferred to Fisk, and as you say, went on a date to the Nashville or the Tennessee State Fair in Nashville, and encountered black restrooms that were, she couldn't go into the white woman's restroom, she had to go to the black restroom, and that it was kind of like a bolt of lightning for her. That summed up all the degradation and that African Americans faced, that she said wasn't really all that aware of until that point, and that moment was a defining moment for her, and she became immediately involved with the growing student movement in Nashville. There were two in the early 60s. There were two really big student movements. The best known in Atlanta and in Nashville. And Diane Nash became lovely, beautiful woman, young woman, became one of the leaders. I mean, became this from this incredibly protected environment. This shy girl became one of the most outspoken, fiery leaders of the national movement. In fact, she became probably the best known leader for a time of the Nashville movement. She was out there leading marches. She was going to jail. She was inspiring, her colleagues, many of whom were male, by her behavior. And she continued that. In many ways, she is one of the key figures of the civil rights movement, and really is not very well recognized, despite all that.
We're running out of time so quickly here this afternoon. The time's flying by. Before we go, I want to ask you to tell us about a woman that I'd never heard of before, and we're going to go back here to the early 20th century, Mary White Ovington.
Yes. Mary White Ovington was white. She came from a fairly wealthy upper-class family in New York City and went to Radcliffe and became a social reformer. Didn't want to get married and became a social reformer. And she is one of the main founders of the NAACP. I don't think many people realize that when the NAACP basically was founded by whites who were appalled at what was happening in terms of segregation and in terms of violence to African Americans around the turn of the century, And it was basically the idea of NAACP in the first place was the idea of Mary White Ovington, this white social reformer who had worked very, very closely with African Americans in New York City. And she was the one who got a number of her friends involved, including a couple of very wealthy white businessmen. And they founded, or they sent out a call for people to get together and to create this organization, both black and white. Mary White Ovington was a close friend of W.E.B. Du Bois, and she was the one who brought him in to the NAACP, where he obviously became a major force. But she was active with that organization throughout her life. Eventually, it became mostly an African American associated organization, but she still remained very much involved with it. And again, she's one of the women that I talk about that most people have never heard of.
Yeah, and she was committed all along to getting and keeping women in leadership.
Absolutely, she was responsible for appointing women. The first executive secretary of the NAACP was a woman. She was responsible for appointing field secretaries who were women, vice presidents who were women. She brought Ida Wells Barnett, one of the great African-American heroines in the civil rights movement early on, into the NAACP. That was very, very important to her. The NAACP strayed a bit from that. In years to come, that's obviously not true anymore, but the NAACP tended to be very male-oriented in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But in the beginning, it was very, very much heavily influenced by women.
Mm. You mentioned Ida Wells, and before we go, I want to talk with you just a bit here about her, because while she turns up over and over and over again in American history as well as African American history, and I suppose that there are biographies of her out there, but in general, in the books that we read coming up in school and in college and whatnot, she doesn't get a lot of print.
No.
And she's very interesting, I'm sure, to you as well as to me, because she was one of the first women investigative journalists, if you ask me. She looked into the lynchings that were so horrific and so numerous.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
At the time.
She at a time when everybody was saying, or not everybody, when the quote popular wisdom unquote, this is right after Reconstruction, was that black men were prone to rape white women. Ida Wells had been horrified that one of her friends, male friends, had been lynched, and she knew he had not raped anybody. She knew that he had been lynched because he was a businessman who threatened the businesses, whose success had threatened the businesses of white men. And so she was a newspaper editor, and that lynching of her close friend prompted her to start an investigation of exactly why black men were being lynched. Was it because they had raped white women, as so many people claimed, or was it for other reasons? And she investigated hundreds of cases and found that, in fact, most of them were for reasons other than rape. Most of them had to do with challenging the prerogatives of whites. And from that, she went on to become the leader of the first real national and international campaign against lynching. And she was at the forefront of it. She traveled all over this country, traveled all over the world to fight against lynching.
Really? All these stories, they're so wonderful. I'm really grateful for you, for having written this book and being out here with us, talking with us about these women.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Lynn Olson has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We've been talking about her book, Freedom's Daughters, The Unsung Heroines of the Civil Rights Movement from 1830 to 1970. The book is published by Scribner. And Lynn's last name, Olson, is O-L-S-O-N.